It's the Burt Cohen Show. Good morning, beautiful business, the unexpected journey of an activist, entrepreneur, and local economy pioneer. And it's all about her opening up a business, being a old radical 60s activist like yours truly, and what she came up with. Back in the 20th century, there was a great deal of political and social and cultural activism, and it was a great time, and we got a lot accomplished. Well, here we are, well into the 21st century, and things have changed a little bit as to how we do things. And a lot of people are in business now. The ideas, the ideals, some of them have kind of faded into the background, but not for our guest today, Judy Wicks. The book is Good Morning, Beautiful Business, The Unexpected Journey of an Activist, Entrepreneur, and Local Economy Pioneer. Well, again, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Bert.
Good food and social activism. It sounds like so much fun, doesn't it? Her new book is just out in bookstores, and there's a lot to talk about. It's going to be some fun, and no doubt I will be hungry at the end of the show. Now, for years, my wife has said, put in a nice restaurant and the neighborhood will follow. Is she on to something, Judy?
Absolutely. Restaurants are important to community life for many reasons, not only to provide good food, hopefully, but also as community gathering places.
Well, yes, and your restaurant is called the White Dog Cafe. You didn't start out as a restaurateur. Rather, it seems you're one of us 60s kids, an activist. And let's trace a little bit of how you got from there to opening the legendary White Dog Cafe, which I believe is in Philadelphia. Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, many things, you know, led that way. I actually got into the restaurant business in a peculiar way. My first business was a retail store called the Free People Store that I opened with my first husband in 1970. And that little store grew to become Urban Outfitters, which is, of course, a very successful, huge international chain. But after about 2 years in that business, I decided to leave and set out on my own. My husband had been my boyfriend in fifth grade, and things had changed, and I wanted to find my own path, and I left the business and the marriage, and got about a block away, and was in a car accident. No one was hurt, luckily, but I needed to find a job right away to repair the damage. And a fellow was walking down the sidewalk and said, "May I help you home with your bags?" And I said, "Oh no, I can't go home. I've just left my husband. My bags are packed, and now I've got to find a job." And he said, "Well, I work in a restaurant, and I happen to know there's an opening for a waitress there." And so I said, "Well, I'll take it." So when people say, "How did you get into the restaurant business?" I always say, "By accident."
Literally. Quite literally. Well, there's that word serendipity. It seems like that's exactly.
That's how it began. I started as a waitress in that particular restaurant that I was referred to, and eventually became the general manager and then a partner in that business. And then I left and started the White Dog on the first floor of my house in 1983.
And I have to ask right off, White Dog. I guess you did not have a white dog. How did you get the name the White Dog Cafe?
Well, it's a very interesting story. When I first moved into the house where I started the White Dog, I had been living there 10 years before I started the cafe. And when I first moved in, a woman knocked on my door late one night, and I answered it. And she said, "Is this the home of the great Madame Blavatsky?" And I said, "Oh, no, no madam that lives here. I live here." And she said, "Oh, no, no. Madame Blavatsky lived at 3420 Sansom Street in 1875. Is this the house?" And I said, "Well, this is 3420 Sansom Street." And she said, "May I come in?" So she came in and was tearing all around my house and saying this is where her bedroom was and blah, 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 and too bad you tore out all the walls, and off she was. And then a few days later, I was on a bus, and out the window, I saw a sign in the window of a building that said, "Who was Madame Blavatsky?" I thought, "Oh, my gosh, that's the woman that lady was talking about." So I hopped off the bus and went in and found out that Madame Blavatsky was the founder or the co-founder of the Theosophical Society, and looked into that and really liked her ideas about universal brotherhood and how all religions are related in their central core. And when people would ask Madame Blavatsky what religion she belonged to, she would always say she belonged to all, because she saw that organized religions divided people, and she thought that really we had so much in common. So I kind of liked her philosophy about many things, and so I decided to name the restaurant after her 10 years later, but I didn't want to call it Blavatsky's Cafe. So I read the letters that she wrote while she was living in my house and looked for the ones with my return address, 3420 Sansom Street, and discovered a story that she had told about in a letter about how she had fallen and hurt her leg, and it had gotten infected, and the doctors had suggested that her leg be amputated. And she would, she said she would have none of that. And she skewered off the, shooed off the doctors, and cured herself by having a white dog sleep on her leg.
Oh my goodness. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe Shirley MacLaine played Madame Blavatsky in a movie.
I don't, not to my knowledge, but that's possible.
I think she did.
Wow.
I know I've heard the name. Well, yet another thing to check out. If you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is Judy Wicks, founder of The White Dog Cafe, the new book just out in the stores, Good Morning, Beautiful Business. Now, what took you, just going back a little bit to those wonderful years of the late 60s, what took you to an Eskimo village, a remote village in 1969, and how did that experience shape some of your ideas on how a sustainable economy might work?
Well, that was another really interesting experience for me. I went to live in this Eskimo village in Alaska in 1969, and there I saw a whole different way of life than I had experienced as a young person. The Eskimos believed in sharing and cooperating as the basis of their culture. When a man caught a seal after a long, hard winter, his wife would have a seal party and invite all the women to their home to divide the meat and blubber evenly between all the families. And then anything else that the family had collected during the year that they didn't need to survive was also redistributed, you know, to the other families. And there was no concept of hoarding, you know, more than you actually needed, and no concept of envy. So if you admire something an Eskimo has or is wearing or whatever, they'll give it to you. So you always have to be cautious what you say and admire about Eskimos.
Yeah, wow.
But, you know, it compared to my own culture, it made me look back, you know, at our own culture from a distance and realize that we actually use envy to drive our economy. You know, all the advertisements with the beautiful models and the macho guys and drinking a certain beer, smoking a certain cigarette or whatever, that we create envy in order to get people to buy more than we want. And we admire those who accumulate the most, who hoard the most, really, who have the largest houses and number of houses and cars and wardrobes and whatnot. And so it gave me a different perspective as a young person that here's a civilization that had lasted for thousands of years that was based on cooperation and sharing. So that had a big impact on me.
Wow, interesting to get that insight there. That you know, I've often wondered about this envy and greed and hoarding. It's like we believe there's not enough to go around. That there's real scarcity. What the reality is, and it sounds like even in the Eskimo world, where I think we would think there's a real scarcity of food, but maybe it's a different context and a different understanding of, you know, goods that there are. Fascinating.
Right. I mean, I think that the Eskimos did believe in the abundance of the universe.
Wow.
And that there's enough if we're willing to share. And, you know, and they've kind of proved that that's the case as they survived in this very difficult and harsh environment. And they've survived by being a community. And I also saw how happy they were. It was just the happiest people I've ever met.
Yeah.
They just took delight in simply being alive on this beautiful planet. And I believe it really stemmed from that their sense of security and their happiness were not based on money, but rather on community. That it was their community that made them feel safe and happy. And it's something that many of us have lost in today's world, where everybody's so on the go, and we've really become separated, you know, from each other and from our land and from nature. And, you know, where the Eskimos really understood that all life is interconnected, that we're connected to other people and with nature and with animals. And so it was really that was kind of spiritual belief of the interconnectedness of all that I was most attracted to in their philosophy. And it wasn't that they talked about it, it's that they lived that way.
Wow. And it sounds like I am reminded of some of the values that we felt perhaps embryonically back in the late 60s, a sense of community, how important community is, getting together and feeling our community in festivals or just being with one another, that maybe there is enough to go around. So bringing some of those old values forward well into the 21st century. And I have to ask about, somehow you had some run-in with Donald Rumsfeld? Tell us about that.
Well, my job in Alaska as a Vista volunteer was my first job, and all the Vistas in Alaska were fired, and we were fired for suggesting that. Well, it was during the 60s, and there was a lot going on, and so we took the side of the indigenous people on the land claims. We took the side of the indigenous people on explaining to them about the Vietnam War and how they should avoid the trap, and they were all put into the National Guard. But there were many issues. The pipeline was a big issue in Alaska right then. And then the last straw was when we organized, and the Eskimo volunteers across, or the Vista volunteers across Alaska, to suggest that our bosses in Anchorage be replaced by the indigenous people. Because in other states, the paying jobs go to people in the community to manage the Vista programs. But in Alaska, the paying jobs went to white people in Alaska rather than to the indigenous people as they did in the other states. So we suggested that the local people have the paying jobs, and that meant that we were suggesting that our bosses be fired. So anyway, all the Vistas in Alaska were fired. We were told that they were going to redo the Alaskan program, and starting with dismissing all of us and kind of starting over again. And then, there was an article in the Washington paper about all the Vistas in Alaska being fired, and that the head of the agency that oversaw Vista and the Peace Corps at the time was Donald Rumsfeld. And he said that Vista was about service, not about social change. And, of course, we were about both, in a sense. And I didn't know who Donald Rumsfeld was from anybody else, but years later when I found this article and realized that I was fired from my first job by Donald Rumsfeld, I thought, how appropriate, you know? It's like being on Nixon's blacklist or something.
I'm envious. Now, I find it fascinating that is one of the things that we've realized from the 60s is that, you know, we were here to bring our wonderful civilization to those other people. Guess what?
Right.
That doesn't work. You know, people want to do things their way and feel like they have some ownership to it. And I have a feeling you found that out. One of the many problems of the political left in the late 60s was that most Americans just couldn't relate. The doctrinaire left never connected with most of us boomers because we're Americans. We like choices afforded us in the marketplace. What was your experience with this doctrinaire political left in that period?
I'm trying to think back. I guess one thing that I have not been aligned with the far left is sort of the anti-business attitude. Now, back in those days, in the 60s, I was anti-business, you know?
Sure.
I thought that business was the root of all evil. And like when we started our first business, our store, I wanted it to be a nonprofit store, that we weren't going to make any profit. We were just going to take what we needed to make a living, and that was it. We wouldn't actually make a profit. But then, you know, that early business experience made me understand that you can't have a business without profit, that a business needs to have profit to, you know, to buy more inventory and to, you know, buy more shelving or whatever, like to grow from a tiny place into just a financially sustainable place. You need to grow a little bit. Now, I think that this whole idea of continuous growth has gotten out of hand in business world. But you do need to have some growth, as all life does, in order to survive. So anyway, I did change my mind, you know, from the far-left anti-business perspective, and that's where I find myself today sometimes disagreeing with the far-left. I think oftentimes continues to be somewhat anti-business, or looking to business owners as kind of the bad guys, you know?
Yeah, it's fascinating how the far-left, you know, the Marxists, there are fewer and fewer of them, luckily, quite frankly, and most people consider me to be on the left, but you got to relate to people. Look, we have a somewhat free enterprise system. I've seen, certainly in my experiences, many, you know, very well-meaning, idealistic enterprises start up that are nonprofit, that don't want to have anything to do with profit or business. And guess what? It rarely, rarely, if ever, works. You know, and if we want to make real political and cultural change, you got to do what works, in my opinion. I mean, it's one thing to protest and feel pure because you didn't get your way. But I personally think it's a lot better to see real change. And it sounds to me like what you've been doing in this White Dog Cafe has, as you said, been a vehicle for good works. That's fascinating.
Exactly. And that's why I call my book, Good Morning, Beautiful Business, because I feel that business can, in fact, be beautiful, one of the most beautiful of human exchanges, when we put our care and our creativity and our energy into producing a product or a service that our community actually needs. And, you know, that we look at our business relationships as the most important part of business, that business is about relationships and money is simply a tool. Business is about relationships with everyone that we buy from and sell to and work with, and also our relationship with nature, which is the biggest, you know, source for business. So, you know, my book is really about that, about how we can operate business in a beautiful way that serves our community, that works in harmony with nature, that can really spread wealth and economic power more broadly, and bring economic power back to our communities instead of having it so concentrated in the hands of large corporations. You know, and I think all of us understand at this point that our own democracy is in jeopardy from undue influence by large corporations. So it's a real, you know, challenging time right now to try and wrestle our democracy back from these large corporations. And I think that some of this work, obviously, is political work to be done. But I think it's also about changing our economy, about you know, taking economic power back to our communities through local business ownership.
And that's one thing here where this show is coming from. Relatively conservative New Hampshire, we like the idea of local control, local decision-making, somewhat of an idea of home rule. Now, it doesn't work all the time, but what we've seen economically in this country, the currently United States of America, is a destruction of the middle class, of small mom-and-pop businesses. There's very, very little opportunity for small businesses, and people like small businesses. You know, you like to go to your local grocery. You like to be able to relate to people and feel like, this is mine. You know, this is my local drugstore or our local restaurant. That must serve you, frankly, pretty well.
Absolutely. You know, and our towns and cities have unique character because of the uniqueness of our businesses, the expression of the individual citizens who have started businesses that are unique to a particular town. And it's just so disheartening when you see the same chain stores in every town. It takes away that identity, the local identity. And it also takes away a lot of meaning and sense of community. That we, you know, it's important to know who grows our food and bakes their bread and brews their beer and makes their clothes and furniture and so on. That these are the relationships, you know, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. These
yeah.
traditionally the relationships that were the foundation of community life. And so much of that has been lost through corporate globalization.
Yes.
And with it, our prosperity, that so many towns have been abandoned as, you know, goods are made overseas and we're left dependent on long-distance shipping routes to bring us our basic needs. You know, food, energy, clothing, building materials are often shipped long-distance.
Yes.
And so part of our movement for local economies is to create self-reliant local economies that produce basic needs in our own communities and regions.
And I think what you're talking about has a great and powerful future, a sense of authenticity, of identity, of community. You know, as I say, the doctrinaire left, they're fading away. It's just, it doesn't work. It doesn't relate. We like to have things. We like to have choices and to do it in a... Dick Gephardt, actually, many years ago, talked about what he called capitalism with a conscience. And certainly restaurants are labor-intensive businesses. Workers generally earn low wages. It always bugs me how, you know, the terribly low wages that restaurant workers get and have to, you know, get tips. And it kind of works. But it seems that, well maybe you can talk to that about, you know, how the restaurant seems to depend on low-paid workers. Is that, how do you deal with that?
Well, it's true. I mean, the whole restaurant industry is set up in a way that the prices that we charge in restaurants aren't high enough to cover benefits for restaurant workers. And I don't know exactly how it got to be that way, but that's just what the public expects.
Yeah.
And it's the case that... you know, that most restaurants cannot afford to provide full benefits for employees, especially tipped employees. Usually there's quite a number of tipped employees who are young and live off tips. And in many cases, these tips are very lucrative. I mean, and people
yeah,
can
sure.
be making, you know, $50,000 a year in tips, and they're young, and so they don't really care that much about benefits.
That's
so
true.
In some ways it works out. But, you know, there's are people who are in the service business as a lifetime career, and you know, it's hard if you're, you know, covered by health insurance and retirement benefits and those kind of things that people in other industries are entitled to. And we tried to do that as best we could at the White Dog. We did provide benefits for servers, certainly not in the beginning. We were just trying to keep our head above water.
Sure.
But as the restaurant grew and prospered, and, you know, I shared that with the employees by increasing benefits for everyone so that even tipped employees eventually had paid holidays, paid vacations, according to their seniority, up to 3 weeks a year for people who have been there for a while, and paying half of health insurance, you know, that kind of thing.
Wow.
We tried to do. That was something that was part of our mission, really. Our mission was to be of service in four areas, serving our customers, serving our employees, serving our community, and serving nature. So I try to make decisions in the best interest of those four areas.
That must put a little bit of stress on the bottom line, whoever keeps the books. If you just tuned in, we're talking with the author of a brand new book, Good Morning, Beautiful Business, Judy Wicks, The Unexpected Journey of an Activist Entrepreneur and Local Economy Pioneer. Now, the conventional wisdom is that to be a successful business, you have to keep costs low to be as profitable as possible. Now, recently you said we too often make economic decisions based on money and not the way our transaction hurts others. But how realistic is that? Doesn't that principle cut deeply into the bottom line?
Well, when I say that, I'm also talking about consumers as well as business owners. And I think we're all at fault in not being mindful when we make an economic transaction about the consequences. You know, whether it's buying meat, you know, whether we're a consumer going to the grocery store or to a restaurant,
right,
or we're a restaurant or a store buying wholesale meat, is that meat raised in a way that's fair and respectful to the animals? And is it raised in a way that's good for the environment, or does the meat come from an industrial factory farm situation where there's great brutality and disrespect for animals pollution towards the environment? But a lot of times we don't think of it, and I think that's partly because of this whole idea of separation. We're very separate, you know, from who grows our food and who sells it too. In many cases where we buy in chains and we don't know where things come from. We don't know when we buy a candy bar as a consumer or buy chocolate as a restaurateur where that chocolate comes from. Are the cocoa beans harvested by slaves, as a very large percentage of cocoa beans are?
Wow.
But we're just not mindful, and I think it's often just the way we're raised. We don't think about it. We don't think about the power of our dollar and what we're voting for, in a sense, when we buy certain things.
That's true, and so often, many people have been involved in electric generation political issues. You know, most people, they flick on a switch, that's it. They don't think about where the electricity comes from. But I do think that more and more of us are thinking about, you know, how far does that have to be shipped to us? How does the animal get treated here? We want to, it's not, as you mentioned, you know, totally separate. I think it's been traditional that people see it, you know, you just flick the switch, that's the end of the story. But that's not how it works. And I think the consciousness is coming around to that, and businesses like yours help make that happen. I think people appreciate that. The more and more people want to know that. You must get a sense of that from, frankly, satisfied customers. They must talk to you about, you know, how they appreciate your you know, being understanding that we're part of a big circle of life, if you will.
Exactly. Our customers definitely understand that. And that was one of the, I think one of the benefits people often say, well, didn't it hurt your profits by doing all these progressive things about, you know, buying renewable energy or whatever, but the customers appreciated it.
Sure.
And I think that our popularity and the longevity, the restaurant's now 30 years old, and I sold it 4 years ago, but the values continue in many ways. I can talk about that later. You know, I think that the fact that we've been in business for 30 years is largely because of what we've done in the community and the model we've set and the appreciation that our customers has shown to us about that.
Talk about customers. Your restaurant, the White Dog Cafe, is now, I think it's fair to say, legendary. What is your customer base? How diverse is it? Is it a she-she, yuppified restaurant or more of a neighborhood?
Well, it's a neighborhood restaurant in the feel of it. We were located on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania, and there's a menu for the bar. There's a small kitchen in the bar, and that menu is really geared towards the student community and you know the local, the neighbors that might want to just walk over and have a quick bite. So we have a menu there that's, you know, like the chicken wings and burgers, but all, you know, the burgers that come from Buck Run Farm, they're burgers that, you know, come from a particular farm where the beef is grass-fed and so on. So everything, even in the cheaper menu, is quality and very mindful in terms of where we get the products. So, but anyway, there's, you know, things like, you know, hummus and grilled vegetables and whatever at that menu, which has kind of a very diverse clientele. When I opened the restaurant, I didn't want to be a student bar. And so I was very mindful about how to groom the crowd to have an intergenerational crowd. And so I used music, you know, to do that by playing music from the 40s, kind of a live group called the Swing Set, clarinet and so on. Anyway, so the clientele is intergenerational. We have some students, but many ages. And then in the dining room, it's more expensive and more complicated. The menu is much more complicated, and so it's competitive with good restaurants in Center City, Philadelphia, or New York, or San Francisco, or whatever, with you know really creative dishes of high quality. And so you know, we don't get so many students unless the students have their parents visiting for the weekend, and then, then
nice.
They come
to
the dining room.
I'm sure they appreciate that. And you must tell us about Gertrude, wonderful Gertrude.
Yes. And, you know, I think that's what the White Dog was known for more than anything, was buying from local farmers. And we started buying from farmers back in 1986. So we were considered a pioneer in that movement.
Well, no, I was asking about Gertrude, a woman named Gertrude, one of your customers.
Yes. You said good food.
I know you did. I'm sure you have good food. Tell us about Gertrude, wonderful Gertrude.
Yes, Gertrude. Well, I met Gertrude back when I was working at La Terrasse, the restaurant I had before the White Dog back in the 70s. And she was in her 70s when we met. And I loved the way she played the piano. It was called a stride style. And she played old-fashioned songs. And we became friends. And she would play every a New Year's Eve and New Year's Day and Mother's Day and Father's Day, Easter, you know, some of the major holidays. And I remember the first time she played New Year's Eve, and I was just getting to know her, and a busboy streaked nude through the restaurant at midnight. And, you know, I thought, oh my dear, I wonder what an elderly lady like Gertrude will think about this. Maybe she'll be so upset she won't want to come back again. And the next day at brunch, she was explaining what happened to a friend of hers that came in for brunch on New Year's Day, and she was telling him about the busboy running around the restaurant. And then she said, and where do you think he tied a big red bow? And so then I knew that she was very fun-loving and easygoing about things like that. Not that we had nude busboys running around any other time.
Right.
but she's quite a character. And then when I started the White Dog, she started playing there. And then she did pass away about a year after we opened. But
people like colorful characters. That's what neighborhoods are, is colorful characters. There are places around here that are local places where you get Democrats, Republicans, all kinds of different people, young and old, and it's a wonderful place, and it brings people back in, which makes me think about something that Ben Cohen, no relation here that I know of Ben and Jerry's, introduced you to the idea of a multiple bottom line.
Exactly.
What is that?
Yeah. Well, and Ben and Jerry's, Ben started this at Ben and Jerry's. Rather than measuring success as a business by the traditional single bottom line of profit, that we should look at the impact that our business has on society. And so they had a social mission, and at that time it was called a double bottom line of how, you know, how do you measure success by profit and also about our impact on our society? Have we made life better for the people around us and the people involved in our business? And then later that concept was expanded to make it a triple bottom line, to have the environment be a separate measurement from people. And then the triple bottom line was called profit, planet, and people. And the whole idea is that, you know, we don't make decisions simply on the basis of how much money, how much profit this will make, but we make decisions on the basis of what will be the impact of this decision on profit, but also on people and planet. And that's the multiple bottom line concept that has been very useful in spreading the idea of a responsible business.
And I do think that's been a little successful for Ben and Jerry's, which of course has been sold to Unilever, but it did create a very successful model. They had a good product, and people like that. They do. They like to think that a company is treating people fairly, that it's treating the earth fairly. It seems to be work. It seems to me, maybe I'm wrong in this, but traditionally, business success has had kind of a macho or masculine tinge to it. Could you, you know, the dominating, strong, you know, pushing ahead, can you paint a picture of how perhaps bringing in a feminine side, bringing in a balance between head and heart, actually adds to business success, that the macho model is not the only one possible for success?
Absolutely, and that's a big theme in my book and in my own evolution. In being a child who poo-pooed feminine values of nurturing and caring and so on as a tomboy, to fully embracing them as a business person. The way I heard it expressed best was by a farmer who supplied the White Dog, and he once told me that good farming is the balance between the masculine qualities of efficiency and the feminine of nurturing. And that if you had too much nurturing, you might have great vegetables, but if you didn't have enough efficiency, you'd go out of business. On the other hand, if you had too much efficiency and not enough nurturing, you wouldn't have a good product. And I think that when you look at our economy, that there's too much masculine energy, you know, too much focus on efficiency, you know, on wringing out the last little penny, you know, from workers, from the land, from the animals, and not enough nurturing, and that this masculine, and I think that the whole idea of masculine has moved from being the protector to being the exploiter to being the dominator, you know, and and I'm, when I talk about masculine and feminine, I'm not talking about gender. I'm talking about the masculine and the feminine qualities that each of us have as human beings.
Yes.
And that to be a successful human being, we need to balance these qualities. And, you know, and we certainly would not have an economy if we didn't have efficiency. And, you know, I've certainly seen situations where there's too much feminine energy and you know, there could be a lot of love and but not enough efficiency to make the business last. So it's the balance that we're seeking, the balance that's, you know, inherent in each of us as human beings.
Very interesting. It seems that different approaches to the world in general in terms of foreign policy. We've had a very, very macho, we're going to dominate these lesser cultures for a long time. Guess what, folks? That doesn't work very well. I mean, it seemed to for a long time. And you have to have a mixed economy. You know, we're not going to go to, you know, Marxism, communism, and then, you know, just totally unrestrained corporate capitalism isn't exactly the best model either. So it's. I think you're talking about something in between, and certainly personally for mixing our head and our heart. It's often a tough balance. I can tell you, you know, the head wants to dominate sometimes, the heart other times, but mixing it takes work. It takes work to get through life, doesn't it?
That's the other way of sort of describing the masculine and the feminine, the way that some people do is, you know, the head is more the masculine, the heart is more the feminine. But again, those characteristics in each of us, male and female, both. But I think that in business, it's so important to make decisions with both the head and the heart.
That's
that,
true.
You know, I've been, some of the most important decisions I've made, you know, for instance, buying 100% renewable energy, or paying a living wage to my staff, to mentoring teenagers. Some of these decisions have been made from the heart, you know, with balancing the heart with the head.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're too much in your head, sometimes you're not motivated. You might know what's the right thing to do intellectually. Like, I knew it was intellectually important to buy renewable energy, but I wasn't motivated to do that until I was touched in my heart by the effect on the woods that I loved. And so on. So, and I think oftentimes in the business world, we're taught to repress our heart, you know, repress the feelings that we need to make. We've got to have that stiff upper lip and, you know, make decisions from the head. And as you mentioned, foreign policy is the same way. You know, our foreign policy is often around domination.
Yes.
Of other countries, militarily and economically.
Oh, for sure. Boy, to keep that balance. And you talk about, you know, mixing the heart and the head and, you know, foreign policy. You did some really unique stuff with your political activism and being a restaurateur. You led customers and employees to places like Vietnam and Nicaragua. That's a little bit different. And you got arrested at the School of the Americas, also known as the School of Assassins. How did that relate to your efforts in the White Dog neighborhood to stop a bulldozer from making way for chain stores? There's a lot there. Give us some reaction.
Well, we can start with the bulldozer. the block that I moved onto and lived in a house there for 40 years, 3400 block of Sansom Street, was threatened by demolition. And this was before I actually started the White Dog. I had just moved in there, and I loved this little block. It was a beautiful row houses, brownstone Victorian row houses with little Victorian detailed cornices across the top. And it was just a friendly little oasis in this otherwise kind of bleak institutional area where so much had been torn down and just modern buildings put into place, these high-rise dormitories and strip malls and whatnot. And so I was just enchanted with this little block that I made my home for 40 years. And then all of a sudden I heard that the block was going to be torn down to make way for a mall of fast food restaurants and chain stores. So I was aghast at this. And, you know, I joined the community group to try and keep them from being torn down. At one point I heard a bulldozer coming up the back alley and saw that the back half of the block that faced the street on the other side of the block, Walnut Street, those houses had been evacuated, and the bulldozer was coming up the back alley behind our houses and was starting to, to ram into the back of all those buildings to do terrible harm to them.
My goodness.
So I just ran over to, you know, to the restaurant and yelled for them to call our lawyer so we could get a restraining order and appeal the court decision. And then I ran out back, and I just didn't know what else to do, but I just lay down in front of the bulldozer to stop them from further damaging the houses until we could get the restraining order. And at the time, or looking back on that, I thought, well, isn't this peculiar that a 60s kind of person, my first act of civil disobedience wasn't around the Vietnam War or civil rights or whatever, but rather to protect our community from the onslaught of corporate globalization in the end. But I realized eventually that this was about justice. This was about democracy. This was about freedom. Because this fight now that we're in, and I call it, you know, kind of a battle in a sense, to protect our communities and our local economies from control by large corporations that are sucking the money right out of our communities through these chain stores and concentrating power, you know, in the hands of a few.
Right, right.
And this for me also led to my interest in foreign policy and how we could change American foreign policy.
So how did... What led you to the idea of taking customers and employees to Vietnam and Nicaragua? I haven't been to Vietnam, but I have been to Nicaragua back when the Sandinistas held the power.
Right. Well, that's what inspired me. Having seen what happened during the Vietnam War, where I thought our government deceived us about the purpose of the war, and many lives were lost on both sides, and I didn't want the same thing to happen again. And so when the Reagan administration was saying that the Contras were the freedom fighters, that we were putting our money behind the Contras to overturn the Sandinistas, who they said were communists. And, of course, the Sandinistas had overthrown Somoza, the dictator who was friendly to the United States, and the United States wrongly, you know, supported many dictators around the world for our own economic purposes, political purposes, and so the Sandinistas had overthrown them to try and have a more democratic society, and the Reagan was supporting the Contras. So I just didn't want the same thing to happen again. I didn't want to be buffaloed as I was in about the Vietnam War when I originally believed that we were fighting on the right side there. And so I decided to go down, but I couldn't figure out how can a restaurant be involved with foreign affairs. And so I heard about sister cities and thought, well, we can have sister cities. Why can't we have sister restaurants? So I developed a sister relationship with a restaurant in Nicaragua and went down there to learn and brought my customers and my staff to hear from them. What do they think about the Contras and the Sandinistas? And as business owners, were the Sandinistas communists? Were they interfering with their businesses? And so I learned a lot there, and that wasn't being reported in the mainstream news. And so I realized the importance of getting American citizens to go to countries and understand how our foreign policy was affecting the lives of people in other countries.
And so you took some customers and employees.
Customers and employees, and you know, we went to Cuba to understand about how the embargo against Cuba since 1960 has affected the Cuban people. And we brought a dishwasher and waiter and bartender, and you know, I took three groups down there, so we were able to take three or four employees each time, along with about 15 customers. And so it was very educational for all of us. And then we also went to Vietnam to understand about the embargo that the U.S. at that time had against Vietnam. Went to the Soviet Union, all different places. In fact, we nicknamed the program Eating with the Enemy because we ate with the Zapatistas and the Sandinistas and the Soviets and the Cubans and so on. And but the point we're trying to make is that world peace comes from dialogue and understanding, you know, not from military and economic superiority.
Boy, that's so, you would think, obvious how getting together with people for a meal is always been with us. It's a timeless function of who we are as human beings. And the fact that President Obama these days is sitting down for dinner with various Republicans in the Senate and the House, and how important that is. We're all at a table at a level, at the same level. How important that is. And certainly one of my heroes, George McGovern, used to talk about, you know, how much more effective Americans' policy could be with the developing world if we help them out with food, with medicine, with things that they need, and just respected people and talked pretty much at a similar level and didn't try to dominate. And it seems to me one of the things that you're saying is that capitalism doesn't have to dominate and control, that we can work with other people, that it doesn't have to be either, you know, total communism or, you know, total dominating, controlling capitalism, that it can be, you know, head and heart mixing in there. Fascinating situation. Now, we have about 6 billion people in the world these days. I guess it's soon going to be 7 billion, something like that, which is just impossible for me to think about. And there's various different ways of approaching feeding the world. We have this rapacious corporate globalization, which is trying to turn every part of the world into all the same. McDonald's, whatever, you know, just the same everywhere you look. A terrible homogenization. So there's one part of that. They force us to eat genetically modified organisms into our foodstuffs. As the, you know, they say, well, this is the way to feed the world. And, you know, agribusiness certainly has a big leg up in terms of getting their product to the 6 billion or so of us. From your experiences, Judy Wicks, do you have ideas on how other ways we might actually feed the 6 billion of us, which might actually help build community?
Yes. I mean, the way I think about it is that we need to have a global economy that, rather than being controlled by these large transnational corporations, is decentralized, that it's self-reliant local economies that are then connected through fair trade relationships around the world with small-to-small, intricate network of relationships, but that our basic needs are produced at home. And, you know, I think the way to feed the world is for each community to be self-reliant in what we need to live, in food, energy, and water. And that if every community did have food, water, and energy security, that provides the foundation for world peace. And I think that the way that corporate globalization works is that every community is dependent on corporations to ship our basic needs long distance, you know, food, energy, building materials, clothing, whatever. And, you know, that leaves all of us vulnerable and dependent on large corporations to bring us what we need to survive. And so we're in jeopardy, I feel, and danger to not be self-reliant in basic needs in our own regions. These long-distance shipping routes can easily be disrupted by weather and social upheaval, which is now on the increase because of global warming. And of course, this long-distance shipping is just spewing a lot of carbons into the air, which is increasing the problem. But the problem is that, you know, the weather is going to continue to get worse, even if we right. are successful in lowering our carbon emissions, and we need to protect ourselves, and by growing the food that we need in our own local regions. So I feel like we should be helping every community to do that, rather than making them dependent. But things that go in the opposite direction. We provide these subsidies to large corporations so they can dump underpriced corn into Mexico and rice into Haiti or whatever, and put the local farmers out of business and make the people dependent on the long-distance shipping.
And so, guess what? Guess what? They get angry about that. People don't like being dependent and not being able to participate in the decision-making about their own future.
Right, exactly. And I really feel that this is, you know, that this concept of community self-reliance is the place where we can bring the right and the left together. That traditionally the right it really respects self-reliance, you know, but it's more about individual self-reliance. And the left really respects community and what we can do together. And oftentimes is not doesn't have as much respect for the self-reliant entrepreneur. So you put these two together, the community of the left and the self-reliance of the right, into the concept of community self-reliance, that we work together to build community self-reliance. I think that's the meeting place of the right and the left, and certainly something that we need in today's world.
And I want to make sure we touch on something that you and your colleagues founded, BALLE, Bally Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. Tell us a little bit about that, what the goals are and how it's working.
Yeah, well, Bali is an alliance of local independent businesses and business networks around the United States and Canada. And we're working in about 80 different communities now that have memberships in Bali Alliance. And what we do is to connect the leaders, you know, that are working in these local economies. One of the problems, you know, when you're working locally, is you're often cut off, or you feel alone, you know, from what's happening in other places. And so we try to connect the leaders so that they feel that they have allies that they can share their issues with and their success stories. And that's the other thing we do at Bali, is we share the stories, we share the success stories, we share the models. So that if you know, whether it's the way a particular business network interacts as a model, then we share that with another community, or it could be a particular business that someone started, a locally made clothing manufacturing company that's very successful. So we take that business model to a different community. So we share these models, and we also, our third part of our strategy is to drive capital towards local economies. That we need capital, that we have to, if we want to have a new economy, we have to stop investing in the stock market that's just perpetuating the old exploitive, extractive economy, and put our investments and put our money into our local economy. And that's something I did in 1999. I inherited stocks from my parents, and I ended up selling it all and putting every penny into my local reinvestment fund, where that money is used to invest locally, including in capitalizing the wind turbines that bring the renewable energy that, you know, we use in our homes and businesses here. So I think that's an important thing for people to understand, that it's not just buying locally and supporting our local businesses, but to invest locally.
Yes.
So that our investment dollars go to start more businesses in our community that help to build local self-reliance and build a healthy and happier community.
A little plug here for my own shows. I did a show very recently. I urge people to check it out, theburtcohenshow.com, about public banks. You know, looking at it differently here, that investing in our communities. But we'll veer away from that just for the moment. Now, we have just a couple minutes left. These days, people feel frustrated. They feel angry. They sure as heck don't trust Congress. And people feel like they'd like to be more socially and politically active, but just don't have the time. Do you have a response to that?
Well, you know, I think that people can, I think that the way that we spend our money is also a vote. It has enormous political implications. And I think it is important that everybody votes and everybody is knowledgeable about what the issues are when we pick candidates, and really think about how a candidate, you know, is going to affect our relationship with other countries or affect our economy and so on. But I also think that there's a great, that everybody has power.
Yes.
In the way that we spend our money. And if we spend our money in a mindful way, that's a big factor in creating the world that we want.
Absolutely. Well, this is fascinating. If I'm ever in the area, I'll have to check out the White Dog Cafe. The book is Good Morning, Beautiful Business. What a great title. The Unexpected Journey of an Activist Entrepreneur and Local Economy Pioneer, and it's put out by Chelsea Green. Judy Wicks, thanks very much for being with us. Very informative, and it's always nice to have a little bit of optimism, see things that actually work and can make a difference. Thanks so much for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show.
Thank you, Bert. It was fun.
Yes, bye-bye. Indeed. And it's all about food.
Hamburgers, cheeseburgers, spaghetti rice, french fried potatoes and goulash. Take over easy asparagus beer, hot dogs and baked beans and sour cream. Red butter, mushrooms in chicken pot pie, pink lemonade. One thing that we gladly doff our shells for, so we present our recipe and wish you well for.
You take 2/3 cups of flour, a teaspoonful of salt, a quarter pound of butter, add an egg. Sugar, a teaspoon of baking powder, 30 minutes in the heat, and it's over.
Two biscuits, a little soup, ham on rye, hot apple, pineapple sundae.
Ooh,
honey, you are in joke, hearts of lettuce, buttered bagels, and lobster cream cheese fruit.
Peanut butter sandwiches, English muffins, rum pops, berries, fish, bacon, bacon. Boy, bacon, nuts, and chocolate, moose, grits, parsnips, tacos, marmalade, juice, the pot, turtle soup.
Well, those brownies ought to be just about ready now. Why don't we go have one, I mean, really.
Who the heck was that? That was the Turtles. The song is Food. Hey, thanks very much for listening.